I place great faith in the observations of Hugh McKay, social researcher, his judgments on people and on issues, and he talks of my next guest as a true blue social democrat, a humanitarian and an internationalist. He was once a member of the University of Western Australia's Liberal Club. In other words, he was on the dark side. But Jeff Gallop is one of the increasingly small group of politicians who came to power, Labor power, not after years of behind-the-scenes scheming, but when the job became vacant. These days, however, he's a professor. Professor Gallop. Jeff is director of the Graduate School of Government at the University of Sydney, and I hold in my left hand a collection of essays and speeches he's written since 2006, Politics, Society, Self, Occasional Writings. Jeff, I want to explore your ideas for creating a healthier society, one in which the well-being of its members and the health of environment is given equal status alongside economic growth. We've been talking quite a lot lately about the notion of endlessly escalating GNP and the concept of progress. But it's time, of course, to reevaluate this. Last night, we were discussing whether continued economic growth is even possible. From your perspective, should we continue to rely on it as a panacea on the so-called trickle-down effect?
Well, thank you very much, Philip. I think I would come at the issue from a slightly different direction and also point out that I think in countries like ours, although perhaps less so Australia, given our unique comparative advantage in the world economy at the moment, but countries like ours generally, the Western capitalist countries, growth will be constrained. So I think that needs to be a starting point. I don't think we can ever go back. The newly developing economies in China and India, which are running ahead at very fast rates of growth, they have labour supply, they're going through the classic process of industrialisation, and on a crude analysis of economics, they're in a very strong position to get that big growth, and we're not. So I think we have to start with that assumption that perhaps we're not going to get that growth. Add on to that the feeling in the community that's been there for some time now, and it's been seen as a sort of an optional extra rather than a necessary reality for politics, to get the balance right between our economic objectives, our social and our environmental objectives. Nowadays, I think that what was seen as a bit of an option, a bit of a luxury, you know, for people in Western countries, I think actually in our type of society today, if we're actually going to have decent, civilised existence, it's going to be absolutely necessary to bring those three together, because economic growth will not be there in the way that it was in the past. It'll be different, a different type of growth, but I think we're now at that point where the great, you know, the great liberal social democrats, the 19th, early 20th century, John Stuart Mill through to Lord Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, you know, we're going to enter into a much more leisurely period of economic growth. We're either going to make that good for everyone, or it's going to become nasty for everyone.
Well, what factors would a wider definition of societal well-being include, Jeff?
Well, I think obviously you'd have to start with the health of people, and then you'd have to talk as well about the mental health of people, the emotional health of people. Difficult to talk about those things from a policy point of view. Sometimes you can talk about them just in terms of whether their services are available to people who need to be, you know, mended in some way due to an illness that they might have. But also we need to talk about it in terms of the fundamentals of our society and the balance we draw between work and leisure, between, you know, the growth and the environment, between, you know, all of the different possibilities we have in front of us, whether we go for balance or whether we just pick one and ignore the other.
So you're picking up pretty much from where Nobel laureate Sen Stiglitz left off, aren't
very
you?
Very much, very much.
So, and they talk about gross national happiness.
Well, that's been an interesting concept, and I remember I put out a policy paper on this subject before the 1996 election, when I was recently elected as leader of the Labor Party, looking at this concept of alternative measures of development. Some try to get one index, one measure. I think that's probably very difficult to do it, because how do you compare? You know, how do you put a price on some things? So I think the better way to do it is to say, well, let's look at the key measures. You might have a key measure in terms of society that relates to the health of the people, the educational outcomes, key measures in terms of economics, whether they have jobs and a decent income, and of course our classic environmental measures, which not only deal with clean air and clean water these days, but also with the state of the global environment generally. And you can look at these measures and you can use them as a basis to evaluate your performance. And it's not perfect, but it does bring a sense of purpose to government about these issues.
Now, recent OECD work on these issues has shown that one extra year of education leads on average to an increase in output of between 4 and 7% for each person, and it also aids health, doesn't it?
Oh, there's no doubt that the evidence shows that healthy people, committed people, involved people in their society, you know, contributing, are generally healthier. And so citizenship, I think, is a very important part of a definition of a good society. I mean, you can overdo that, of course, but all these things are about balance.
Coming back to health and mental health, I can think of six politicians I know who, like you, have had battles with depression. Mm. Is it an occupational hazard for the politician, or is it, in fact, almost equally a problem right across the community?
There's no doubt it's right across the community. It is interesting to make one observation here, that the law profession, a very individualised profession, has got a very high incidence of mental illness and abuse of drugs and alcohol, for example. And that is an interesting, you know, sociological phenomenon, because, and I think it's a very individualised type of profession. But it's across the board, it's across the boundaries. I mean, you're talking about anyone in any position. We all have predispositions that are given to us, by our inheritance. We have certain experiences. Some people are disposed to it, some are not. Those that are, if you put them in one set of circumstances, you know, depression will emerge, and others it may not, because they don't have that predisposition.
You give an example in your book of Robert Putnam. I'm going back to gross national happiness, who notes the regions of northern Italy have particularly strong networks of community associations, which create richer economics, better government, and more social progress generally. It will come as a great shock to the listener to think that this could be happening in Italy. Talk to that.
Well, I think my understanding of that, and I've read Putnam's works, is the way I read it is this. If you have a good community underneath and supporting your democracy, there's a lot more accountability, and there's no question that accountability is an important element of good government, and that's the whole point of democracy, of course, to have accountability between the government and the people. So I think that's part of it. Secondly, I think the other part of it is it shows that people are interested. And, there's a number of contrasts we can draw in society between a privatised community on the one side and a strong and perhaps tyrannical government on the other, as opposed to a sort of an active citizenry and a good government that is interested in the welfare of its community. And those two things work together to produce good results. So it's partly accountability and it's partly citizenship creating a desire and a capacity and an organisation to do good things.
I'm talking to Professor now, Jeff Gallop, and let me quote you here. Just as you can't straitjacket human society with one culture or one religion, nor can you straitjacket an economy within one system of ownership and control. A healthy economy will involve government and private sector enterprises, as well as other economic forms like co-ops and mutual societies. So you're a great pluralist.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head there, and it's actually been an interesting feature of the last 30 years of public policy, that on the one hand, we've said that we believe in and we want a multicultural society where different traditions can work their way within the community to produce collective betterment through respect and the dialogue that goes on. And yet when we talk about the economy in the last 30 years, 40 years, it's tended to be privatisation. One model, one type of firm, one type of objective. Whereas if you look at the economy, and I tell you who wrote about this some time ago now, was Will Hutton, and you've probably had him on your program,
Philip.
This idea that if the capital market has you know, there's different options for banking, there's different options for organising production. It sort of balances out a lot better. And I think pluralism, we think, is a good thing for society. We think of freedom of thought, expression, we think that's all good. But when it comes to the economy, we've got hung up on market fundamentalism. And private, a lot of privatisation's been worthless, I think. I mean, a lot of it is just redistributed wealth. It hasn't created any wealth. I mean, some privatisations
have
been
good. Like, it's a bit like what went on in Russia, isn't it?
Philip, you put it this way. You're working in the Western capitalist world. Life has got a bit tougher for the employer because, you know, standards have been set. Colonies have gone, you know, no longer imperialism. How do you make money? Well, I think one option that came up, well, look at those utilities over there. Yeah. You know, they're making a lot of money. Perhaps we could be part of that.
But it's a touch of the oligarchs there. And look, I'm going to use a dirty word, poverty. Poverty in Australia. You argue that there's no hierarchy of needs, Jeff. The economic, social, environmental factors are all connected, indeed cannot be separated. How would you describe our government approach so far?
Well, I think the sadness is that when the government came in 2007, like many people, you know, left of centre people like myself, I was so enthusiastic. They're going to rebalance the Federation, excellent intergovernmental agreement on financial relations. They're going to rebalance the labour market, get rid of work choices. Australia's going to have a more balanced view of international policy, you know, not all the way with America all the time, but, you know, more concern for the UN. We'd have more money into aid. And I could keep going through. We'd have more balance between regional and city through the NBN program, more balance between, you know, the needs of individuals for freedom and the desire of a community to have equality. I think they should have really stuck at that, you know, as a major theme and really pushed hard on fairness. I mean, we've got a ridiculous situation in our country where we know now that our education system doesn't equalise in the way that it ought, particularly compared to a lot of European countries. And that's because I think, you know, the aspiration for the commitment to equality has taken a second place, you know, against other aspirations. And I think the government has been, you know, going a little bit here and a little bit there, but their central thrust of rebalancing everything, particularly society, so that the needs and aspirations of people with a lot of money aren't determining all of the outcomes all the time.
We haven't got much time, and I'd like to move to Richard Eckersley, who describes Australia's youth as the miners' canaries of modern society. He said the young have picked up on the failures of modern society to offer meaning and hope for the future. You admire Richard, don't you?
I think when I read that, it just made so much sense to me. And you know, you look at what's happening to politics. You know, the new way in which politics can be conducted. Political parties are now under pressure, just like newspapers are under pressure. You know, the traditional ways of doing things. And so I see a lot of disenchantment with politics, but I don't see all that much disengagement, which does encourage me to one level because there's a lot of activity.
You don't see disengagement? Hugh McKay certainly would.
Well, disenchantment, no question. A lot of disenchantment, some disengagement. But there's still a lot of politics in Australia. A lot of it is populist politics, of course. Politics of the, you know, the easy way. Politics of giving people what they say they want rather than seriously looking at, you know, the balance between, you know, and the contradictory situation we're in and being honest to people. So there's a lot of that populist politics. So there's a lot of politics, I think, still out there.
Yeah, well, here's a quote, a clear case of the arrogance of ideology riding roughshod over the reality of complexity. That's, you know, what this little wireless program has tried to be about for the last 20 years, the reality of complexity.
And how do you get it across, Philip? I mean, I you know, a lot of people don't see this perhaps so much, but a lot of the battles of politics are within the political class. And one of the big battles is between the journalists who want the simple, clear statement, understood and can be presented on the television in the evening, and the person of policy who wants, you know, look, it's not like that. There's an argument here, there's an argument there. We've got to balance it out, and we've got to come with a real solution. But how do you get that into a quick grab for the TV? And this war goes on all the time between those who want to simplify for reasons of presentation and those who want to recognise complexity because they want real outcomes.
We're talking about a pluralism of approaches in politics. I think there's clear evidence that you've used this approach to rehabilitate your own life.
Well, there's no doubt that I was running along on a very fast train, and things were happening, and I wasn't really willing to sort of stop and think what's going on here. And when I did, and also made a decision to leave politics at the same time, there's no doubt that you get a... There's a sense in which you can come to terms with some issues that you've repressed, you know, for a long time. So I think it's... Our society has trouble with that. Individuals have trouble with that. You know, being honest. I'm very interested in the concept of self-awareness as opposed to the concept of free will. I think the concept of free will is a myth. But self-awareness isn't. You know, freedom is something we aspire to and need to develop. Our capacity to understand ourselves and our strengths, and it's an ongoing struggle. It's not
so
a fact.
your self-awareness has increased by orders of magnitude in recent years.
Orders of magnitude, and it all started when I said there's a problem here, because I didn't see it as a problem. I just thought, you know, the fact that you were going through periods of, you know, pretty depressing experience, you know, it's funny, but you don't actually think that that's what it might be. But you can actually deal with these issues. There is treatment, and I think that's the positive side of this whole equation.
So we've got to treat ourselves and treat our society. Good on you,
exactly,
Jeff.
That's
good
exactly
on you,
right.
Jeff. Professor Gallup, Director of the Graduate School of Government at the University of Sydney. The book, Politics, Society, Self, Occasional Writings, published by the University of Western Australia Publishing. Coming up, Bruce Beresford and his passion for opera. But first, a piece of opera.